Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome back to the House of Pod.
My name is Kave. I think I'm saying that correctly. I am the host of this little medical podcast. And today we are getting back to the basics, getting back to the good stuff. Oh, the stuff everyone loves. Everyone loves talking about COVID and infectious disease. People just love it. They can't get enough of it. Give me more of that. Airborne viruses. Love it. So we're going to talk about that today. Joining me to do that, I have some really great guests. I'm really excited to have these two guys on. The first guest you all know very well. He is Dr. Ryan Marino. He is an ER doctor. He is a toxicologist. He has the most magnificent beard of any guests I've ever had. And it makes me so jealous because I want that beard. And it's so beautiful on you. Ryan, welcome back to the show.
Well, hello. Thanks for having me back.
Man, it's good to see you, buddy. I feel like it's been so long. It's only been like a month or two, but I feel like it's been forever.
Yeah. And I'm surprised you were willing to have me back here.
Are you kidding me? You're like my fave, man. I love seeing you. Can I be real? Can I make you blush a little bit?
Yeah.
Seeing you lowers my blood pressure a couple points at least. Just seeing it brings me a sense of peace, a sense of calm. I'm like, I love the look at that face. It's a lovely face. I mean, this is a radio podcast thing, so people can't see it, but you'll just have to trust me on this one. It's a great beard. But Ryan, thank you for joining me. We're going to get back to some of the original stuff that you and I first bonded over, which is, you know, COVID and that sort of thing. Kind of wanted to do a little recap of the last couple of years, talk a little bit about where we've been, what's going on now, where we're going, and talk about infectious disease in general. And to do that, joining us, we have Dr. Sanjeev Bakshi. He is an MD, MPH, PhD, RAD, EGG, GOD, fantastic guy all around, does a lot of consulting work. You are training to be a flight surgeon, is that correct? How does that work, Sanjeev?
That's right. You just get up in a plane and you train and you fly it, you ride around and you understand physiology in a plane.
Wait, okay. So did you have... Are you just doing this on your own or are you like part of like some government program?
No, so I'm in the Air Force Reserves, and as part of that, take care of airmen and trying to sort of level up my ability to take care of flyers in particular. So that's what the training's about.
Do you have to like go through boot camp and go through all that stuff?
Yeah. When I joined the Reserves, I went to officer training school, which is effectively like boot camp, which you can imagine as like at the time, 34-year-old man was just a very odd situation to be in, but we got through it.
Wait, did they give you like a special boot camp for like old doctors, or did you
That's a very good question. Yes, we went to sort of the special. We did go to the special boot camp for they're like doctors and chaplain and people who join sort of later in life. So in terms of how real boot camp is, I think it was far kinder, but still it was jarring for a lot of us. So
did you grow up watching Full Metal Jacket and Platoon as well?
I mean, I watched them. I thought they were great. I was more, I really did like MASH. So I was a late night TV kid growing up, you know, so like MASH was always great. And that's actually the type of unit that I'm in. We're expeditionary medicine. So it is basically like MASH.
So, okay. Sorry. There's so much to talk about. This isn't the main focus of why I wanted you, but I find it just fascinating. Like just the concept of me having to go to boot camp is just, would be hilarious. Like I'd be like, you want me to climb that wall? Are you sure?
I had a 10-foot wall. I had to jump up on that 10-foot wall, pull myself up, and throw my body over. Yes, that happened.
Oh, my God. Okay, so you are an ID doctor. You're an epidemiologist. We talked about you're doing the flight surgeon stuff now, which is great. You've been deployed a couple times in terms of our COVID response. Can you explain what that means?
Yeah, so as part of the Air Force, I deployed in 2020 to New York City at sort of the peak of kind of what was happening in the United States around March, April timeline. So I went and deployed directly into a hospital and just served as sort of another set of hands and kind of and another doctor just to take care of patients. I did something similar to upstate New York at the beginning of 2022, deployed again as part of the same mission. It's sort of a joint mission between Homeland Security and Department of Defense for COVID-19 support. So
how is your brain after 3 years of being an ID doc in America during COVID? How are you doing?
It's exhausting, but I think it's, it's just one of those things where, as part of this, I've spent time, you know, with some international NGOs, state governments, federal government. And I think, if there was a moment to step up and have your moment, I think COVID-19 was the ID doc's moment, you know? And so if you were going to sort of retreat from that sort of opportunity to be helpful, I think you probably are in the wrong field.
Do you feel like that happened? Like were there ID docs who were like, all right, I'm checking out. I was about to retire. I was thinking of retiring soon. I'm out of here anyways.
None that I really know. I'm sure just like others. I think there are a bunch of docs, you know, whether it be, you know, hospital medicine or whoever, who just got really burnt out, especially early on, and kind of mobilized to either outpatient or maybe even just retired. So I think for some, it probably accelerated that. But I think so many ID docs stepped up and, you know, working 7 days a week for 2 to 3 years, just trying to keep hospitals running, serving public health roles, you know, serving patients out in the community, working on vaccine stuff, testing, you know, you name it.
You know, we talked a lot about criticisms we've had or faced in the medical profession about how COVID has been handled, about COVID information has been dispersed. Let's go and give some grades, if you would be willing to do this with me, this experiment. I want to hear how you would grade these people or groups that are commonly associated with COVID. Let's start with the obvious one, because you talk about being exhausted after these 3 years. I assume the exhaustion now isn't just the taking care of patients. I'm assuming it's all the other stuff that's come up in this, political stuff included. And there's been no bigger lightning rod, I think, in this country than, you know, Dr. Fauci. So what would your grade of Fauci and his handling of COVID be now that his tenure is coming to a close and you've had sort of 3 years to evaluate him?
Yeah, so I've known about Fauci and his work, obviously, for a long time, probably for 20 years. I mean, dating back to his sort of rheumatology work in the 70s, his sort of landmark HIV work in the 80s, and then basically, you know, his sort of shepherding, you know, half a dozen presidents through, you know, understanding and navigating infectious diseases. So I would say two or three things just before I answer that, and then I'm happy to answer it explicitly. One, I think sort of grading Fauci over the last 2 to 3 years largely probably ignores 50 years of service to the country in a specialty where, you know, probably no one else wanted to go do that work, advocating for people that no one else really wanted to advocate for a long time. I'd say that's one thing. Number two, when you grade something, you're always sort of thinking about relative to what. And so it's hard for me to know what an A is, right? Because this is a sort of experience that no one has lived through, certainly domestic in the United States. Last time we had one of these, we really didn't have a vaccine for it, you know, 100 years ago. So I think just the sort of idea of like, how do we feel like people measure up, I think is just kind of difficult for me to kind of benchmark. And then I think that the third thing is, I think a lot of these things are played out over time. And so I would say in many respects, I think the United States is sort of not kind of on a perfect trajectory, but we've done fairly well, especially in the last year or so with respect to COVID, when options were made available to people. And not everyone exercised those options, but of course, being part of a sort of collective in a free country, you know, people do have the right to make those choices. So sort of taking that together, I would say that, like, I think Fauci did quite well. Like, I'm not sure that there's a bunch of people that I would want, that I have in mind who should have taken his spot. And, you know, we've had a number of people who cycled through a variety of seats, you know, whether it be government or otherwise. And I think him as a constant has been actually quite good. So I was really happy with Anthony Fauci and sort of his role and commitment and work throughout COVID-19.
I think that was a really good answer. And I mean, I'm not an ID duck, so I defer to you here, but like, why do you think he has gotten so much hate? Because I agree with everything you said. Do you think it's just because of his visibility?
Yeah, I think he has pretty concrete perspectives, right? They are, although largely mainstream, I think for the sort of sub kind of populations where they are a bit contrarian on things like diagnostic testing, vaccine efficacy, whatever it happens to be, I think it's just the most visible person, to your point, Ryan. Like, he's quite visible. And then I think that, like, he works for the government, right? And you know, I think you know, he's sort of putting himself out there a bit. And I think the last thing is probably I think he was willing to maybe be wrong for what was right in the moment. I think the classic example that a lot of people refer to with that is that, you know, when face masks were quite tight, especially N95s and early 2020s, I think, like, it was Fauci who kind of led the conversation around, we need to preserve these masks for healthcare workers who need it. And then, you know, shortly after, you know, the government more broadly recommended masking as a strategy to mitigate transmission risk. And so I think when you do those sorts of things, and you live in a place that's relatively unforgiving, you know, relatively intolerant of those sorts of misgivings, even if they're totally appropriate at the time, I think you're just going to get called out for it.
It feels like he has been crucified, I mean, for that, among a few other things, but I mean, that's probably like the biggest mistake that his detractors can latch onto. I mean, for lack of a better word, I would probably call them his haters. But I think everyone in the medical community had the same idea. This was the guidance we were given. It was totally normal at the time. And the thing that most people don't seem to be willing to accept is that, like, smart people take new information, change their opinions, can admit when they're wrong. And it feels like Tony Fauci has just been, I mean, crucified for, like, one thing that he did. He's given his justifications. He's admitted he was wrong. I don't know. It's very bizarre to me. And it feels almost like the politicization. Wow. That's a
score. No, you nailed it. Perfect. No notes.
The politicization of COVID, like, ignores the fact that he was appointed to the role by Donald Trump, and I mean, tried to, like, do what was right regardless of politics. I really don't know, like, what we're missing here in terms of Anthony Fauci as a leader in terms of science communication in general, not just infectious disease. I guess I don't have a question here. I was just kind of rambling.
No, I was feeling the same thing, and it's funny to me because I feel like the detractors would, there was a moving target to figure out why they hated him so much. And it would be like the mask thing, or it would be like, oh, there was confusion over whether or not he admitted it was airborne or not airborne. And then there would be some confusion, or they would muddy the argument by bringing up connections to Wuhan and funding the NIH and things that, like, it was constantly shifting. And no matter whatever you try to put out one fire, there it would be like whack-a-mole. Some other weird story would come out about Fauci and pop up. It was pretty relentless, actually. I'm not a huge fan of reading memoirs of, like, you know, people who have like this moment like he's having, and but I think he does have a long history of service, and I do think he lived through a really unique period. I heard he is going to be writing a memoir. I probably will read it. I am curious to know, at least from his perspective, how he dealt with that kind of intense hate. And I'm assuming that has affected ID doctors or the interest in going into ID, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, like, you know, he, Ryan, to your point, he is like prided himself on being nonpartisan. He was instrumental in George W. Bush establishing PEPFAR, and, you know, shepherding that probably the most successful international aid program the United States have ever been a part of. Is pretty significant, the impact there. Was an important part of the AIDS conversation, you know, with Ronald Reagan in the 1980s. So I served George H.W. Bush closely. Like, he prides himself on being nonpartisan, so he doesn't have like a sort of lean that he takes to work with him, you know. But I think your point, Kaveh, and like the ramifications of this, I think like the most recent data came out for, you know, ID positions. And I think, you know, something like 85% or 82%, I think it was 82% on the latest 2022 MASH data, folks ended up, like, spots ended up getting filled. I think
that's... So for our listeners who don't know, what that means is every year there's this application process to get into infectious disease training. And I don't know if they usually fill, but I would assume that they normally do. But it sounds like there's been a drop off, and those spots weren't filling because there wasn't enough interest in medical trainees going into infectious disease. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, I think that. So basically there has been a historic decline. So I don't want to sort of attribute anything to COVID unnecessarily, to Fauci unnecessarily. So historically there's always been a challenge in filling spots, and we can talk about why. I think there was a bump last year, which got people really excited. I think we went up to 88% or so of spots being filled, but sort of everyone was kind of brought down to reality again this year when we sort of went back to our historical norm of filling about 82% of slots. I mean, I think the sort of rationale historically has always been, well, it's one of the few fellowships that where you do additional training and you end up getting paid less afterwards. So that's, you know, in the traditional fee for service model, being a non-procedural field, it's really hard to sort of to demonstrate more cleanly the quote unquote value that one brings to the organization, although value can be measured in many ways. Right. I think the other sort of idea on this was that, you know, like maybe more recently with everything that happened with public figures like Fauci, but even other, you know, figures, whether that be individuals at the CDC, other individuals who are advising, you know, the president on the task force, and then sort of challenges that we're seeing elsewhere, you know, globally, that maybe it's less appealing for people. And, you know, maybe that.
I wouldn't blame them. I mean, I do remember in the, like, 2020, there was this sort of like increase interest in people studying infectious disease. You're talking to young medical students who I deal with a lot, and they were excited about it. They were interested in it. But after 3 years of seeing what, like, I thought, you know, pretty reasonable requests from the public health and infectious disease community, how they were treated, how Fauci was sort of demonized. And I don't think Fauci's perfect. And I think there's probably some legitimate criticisms of HIV and AIDS and how it was handled, very legitimate criticisms of how poorly it was handled in the 80s. But I mean, I think honestly, like, to see the kind of hate that he got for doing, I thought, a pretty reasonable job overall, you know, doing his best, at least. I do believe that. And seeing that, I would totally understand why someone wouldn't want to go into that field. It would be almost masochistic at this point if you did, just seeing the kind of hate you get. I mean, did it surprise you the kind of pushback that people had to ID or to recommendations from public health doctors? Does that surprise you in any way?
I don't know if I was. I think I was surprised. So just to be fully transparent on it, I don't think it was as surprising to me, though, because I never really saw what the communication apparatus was for infectious diseases or really like pandemics or epidemic disease before. Like we didn't have that capability, right? Like there's not a person I could have gone to who I could have really effectively talked about that properly in the United States. Some people who do work with WHO and otherwise probably have a better handle on that sort of stuff, but nothing at this scope and scale. So I don't think we were prepared for that. But Kaveh, it goes back to this point that I think is really important, which is like, what is our expectation of people, right? Like I think perfection is like an entirely unreasonable expectation. I think in medicine, like, you know, people take an oath to do the right thing, you know, to like uphold maybe a higher standard than many other occupations. And I think that is totally fair and reasonable. But I didn't see any gross violation of those things, right? And what I did see, and you know, this could have been my experience, my observation, but what I did see is, you know, government employees, state and local employees working 7 days a week, round the clock, trying to do whatever they could to keep hospitals open, you know, working, doing more clinical time than they could have ever wanted. And, you know, being short of basically spit on when they go to work every day. So like, I'm just not like, what I don't understand is sort of, you know, what are people's expectations and why are they so extraordinary? And then to what extent have people violated those expectations in such meaningful ways that would warrant such, you know, difficult treatment.
I have a different theory here, and this is gonna totally take this a different way. I mean, all of those are definitely valid points, but like, you can take Tony Fauci. I mean, became a celebrity whether he wanted to or not, and I think he did a good job of it, as good as anyone could be expected. I'm sure he did better than I ever could do in that role. And he has much more credentials and credibility to be in that role. But certainly, I mean, this was like the moment for infectious disease, and even bad actors got elevated. There are plenty of people. I mean, Monica Gandhi is someone who I think has had consistently terrible takes and continues to enjoy a life of celebrity and fame because of the pandemic. So really, it's kind of surprising to me, because if you're going into medicine and you want some sort of credibility, attention, whatever it is, this seems like it was the moment for infectious disease. And I actually feel reassured deep down, not on the surface level, because there's a lot of problems here, but the fact that people don't necessarily want to go into this specialty after seeing how this has been handled. I mean, you look at the way people are handling it, it's been so politicized, it's been so controversial. People are spit on every day, as you say. I mean, like the state of Florida, their COVID response person is someone who denies that vaccines work and says that COVID isn't a real thing. And that's not unique to Florida.
But they do it really well. I mean, they like really, yeah. They really stand out in that way. Yeah.
But people, I mean, across the board, and it's not just an infectious disease thing, but in statistics and epidemiology, have kind of shown that there is really no bottom here. And so, I mean, I tend to see like if there is a positive outlook here, it's that maybe people just don't want to deal with kind of the hassle of having to like wade through the Monica Gandhis of the world and having to compete with them to get like good information out. And I can tell you, I mean, as someone who has plenty of stresses in my own day-to-day like clinical work, I wouldn't want to deal with those kind of like logistical administrative nightmares, whatever, arguing with people who just want a soundbite. So I don't know.
Well, Ryan, yeah, I was going to say, I think the thing that was most surprising to me, and I think what you're talking about is a big piece of that, is like, I actually was a bit taken aback by the extent of disinformation. And I shouldn't have been so surprised, but like, I think, like, it's just shocking, like, how much incorrect information or data is out there. And but the thing that's surprising for me or difficult to me is I think it creates this, you know, really unfair sort of equity challenge, right? And that, like, I have, you know, whatever number of years of training and experience, and I'm able to sort of look at things and sift through them in a different way and understand the sort of downsides or risk or how valid something might be versus not be. But and then sort of do your best to kind of convey that to others. But I think, like, for the most part, most people don't really have an ability to do that, right? And so they depend or have historically depended on experts or sort of authorities, if you will, to help interpret and guide. Now, I think to your point, like, everyone's trying to get their moment, right? And whether the information is exactly right or maybe a little bit wrong or maybe a lot wrong, right? It's much more about people getting their moment than it is about the information. And I think that sort of challenge has been actually something that I'm just sort of a bit taken aback by. And like, I just don't know the answer, right? But like, I do think it creates massive inequity in information.
And, you know, I've talked to you about this for a while, Sanjeev, and you've always been, I felt, pretty reasonable about this and measured in your responses from about COVID, going back to when we first, you know, ran across it. But you're exactly right. That's not the kind of thing that ABC News is going to want to interview you about. They don't want somebody who's going to come out, and they're not going to want a soundbite from someone who gives a pretty measured response. We'll be like, hey, let's see what the data shows. Hold on. Let's not jump to conclusions. They want someone to say something like, oh yeah, yeah, variant schmariant. We're going to be fine. It's all going to be good. Or they want someone who's going to say something more outlandish on the other end, like, everyone in this country is going to die with this new variant that's come out. They want some crazy soundbite. That's, I think, a real problem in medicine in general, and in particularly now, because infectious disease, like we're talking about, is having this moment. But that's a real problem. Like, the people I see on the, it's funny because of the show, I have people like Ryan and people like Jeremy Faust come on. It's really fun to then see them in a newspaper, right? But for every one of those guys who gives like a pretty reasonable expert opinion and something that they've studied pretty in some great depth, you know, you'll get these sound bites from doctors who are now becoming known just for that, for these hot takes. And that's frustrating. And I don't like seeing doctors compete for that. And that's one of the reasons I backed off of Twitter, because there's like this contrarian med Twitter section of people with a pretty large following, so it has to be taken kind of seriously, who just are, it's almost like they're challenging each other for who could have the weirdest, hottest take on these things, because they know it's going to get likes, they know it's going to get retweets, and they know it's going to get eyes, and maybe it'll translate to something that'll get them down the road, like a spot as a Fox pundit or something. So it's really that is really a concern for me right now. I don't see that necessarily getting better. I don't know what to do about that. I don't know if that's science education, or if we just got to wait it out, or if we need people like you two constantly out there fighting and advocating and battling misinformation. You know what I mean?
Well, I think, and Ryan, I'm interested in your take on this too. I think there has been some serious harm done to institutions and the sort of concept of expertise. I remember when I graduated med school, you know, one of the faculty told me, he said, you know, it takes a lifetime to build your reputation. It takes only a moment to destroy it. Right. And I think that's collective. That's like just beyond any one person in medicine. I think collectively, because, you know, so many people have sort of used the moment in the spotlight to do as they please. We sort of put our expertise out there almost for sale or whatever. And I think that's a hard thing to claw back. Right. And so, like, if you're willing to sort of lower your standards on what it takes to make recommendations or to provide insights, it then becomes a playground for a lot of other people who don't necessarily have the expertise to parse through that information. Mm-hmm. And you're sort of playing like a very kind of bizarre game where I think it's not about your training and not about what you're able to bring to the table. And it's more about sort of who's gonna have the more kind of, you know, to your point, hot take. I don't know, Ryan, what you think.
Yeah, I mean, I think you both have been kind of like leaning in the same direction here with this conversation, and I agree. And I think, I mean, when it comes to infectious disease, virology, epidemiology, in the setting of the pandemic, we've seen like people who have no expertise in these topics become like vaulted into...
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Popular perception as experts. I mean, people who do like cash clinics for platelet injections into people's knees are now epidemiologists in COVID. That I think, I mean, really hurts everybody. And expertise is something that matters, and not to be kind of like a credentialist or anything, but like I look to experts in certain areas for information. And when the people who are dominating the conversation don't actually have the expertise or are coming at it with some sort of intentional message or politicized message, which feels very often, or, I mean, at the end of the day, maybe it's just that they were for sale and their message is something that someone paid them to say, that I think is worth mentioning. Especially, I mean, when it comes to infectious disease, because infectious disease doctors, like you said, they do a fellowship and then end up making less money. And as a medical toxicologist, I mean, I
did feel that
emergency medicine. Yeah, I could make a lot more money just being an emergency doctor.
Yeah.
So
speaking of that, and we are going to go back at some point and give Fauci this grade. I'm not letting you off the hook on this. It will accept pass, not pass, but. Before we get back to that, you know, given what you went through to become an infectious disease doctor, given the pay, you know, I mean, it's not bad pay, but you're right. You could get paid more doing something else easily in medicine. So I'm not even going to ask if you would do it again, because I assume you would. And I think in reality, whether or not it's true, if I ask any doctor that, they'll usually say they'd do it again. Whether or not they actually would, I don't know. But they would say it. But let me ask you this. If your nephew came to you and was like, hey, I'm in medicine right now, I'm torn, I'm thinking dermatology, no call, good money, good options, fairly chill lifestyle as being a doctor goes, or infectious disease, what would you tell them?
Yeah, I'm still pretty idealistic about it. So if there's really... And the last 3 years doesn't necessarily change how I thought about it. I will say, you know, 10 years ago when I did my fellowship, the climate at that time didn't really impact how I thought about it either. And so I would suggest them just to follow where their passion is, because I think, you know, life can be incredibly short, and you may not be able to determine what sort of takes you sort of in and out of this life, but like you can at least make some decisions about what you're happy doing. And I've sort of said that for a long time, and I stick to it still. And I would have, you know, back then still done it. I think it was very confusing for people to have done infectious diseases and then to have gone and done epidemiology and then to do consulting after that. And it's a bit winding of a path. But I think for me, you know, I got lucky in that it all sort of came together where I could be helpful during COVID. I think, and a lot of that is just because I was really still excited about infectious diseases and, you know, the field and, you know, the dramatic, pretty amazing things, whether it's Hep C or HIV or, you know, now with COVID coming up with a brand new sort of platform vaccine in 11 months, which is just mind blowing. All of those things are still really exciting.
That's well said.
I'm glad you brought that up too, because we could dwell on the like death of expertise, how the past 3 years have been a nightmare for medicine, for specialties, for all of this. But like there are a lot of positives to take out of this. And I mean, we developed effective vaccines in 11 months, as you said. There's many effective vaccines. I don't know what you think about like the latest controversy about the variant specific booster. But I mean, in terms of kind of looking at the future of vaccine technology in dealing with other infectious diseases, I mean, it seems like the future is very bright for infectious disease as a medical specialty. You guys are going to be accomplishing a lot of things that weren't able to be done ever before, and probably no one ever thought was going to happen in this kind of timeline. So it still is, to me, really exciting when I think about infectious disease. It was one of the specialties I considered as like a medical student.
That makes sense. That makes many, that totally many years out. Ago. Yeah. That totally. You hear that, young kids out there, young youth out there trying to figure out what you want to do. It's the cool kids do infectious disease. You should still do it. I think it's going to be great. I agree. Okay, so pass, fail, A, B, C. What would you give them?
Definitely a pass. Like an A for me would have to, like, I'd have to understand what we're benchmarking against. That's my whole point, is that like I do think the standards out there are entirely unreasonable, because I don't think perfection is a fair standard for anyone. So I certainly give him and the sort of many of the other people who dedicated so much of their life over the last 3 years a pass, certainly.
Okay, so let's move on to a different group then. Let's move on to the World Health Organization, the WHO, not the awesome band that I love and probably was a prototype for punk rock in the United States. We're talking about
that's what the World Health Organization named themselves after, right?
I would hope. won't get fooled again. That's for sure. I didn't mean anything. I just wanted to throw in a title of a WHO song. So Sanjeev, first, before we talk about that, there was a lot of confusion initially, and I think the WHO, or who, I don't know if I should call them the WHO. That doesn't make it sound like I'm talking about Pete Townsend. But there was confusion initially about whether or not they would call COVID airborne or not. Can you clear up that confusion and explain maybe where that came from, where that confusion came from?
Yeah, I'm not totally sure where it came from. I do know that as the sort of chief scientist left WHO recently, she said her sort of biggest regret was delaying the decision on, you know, calling it airborne. I think many people were, and I don't necessarily think this is what WHO was or was not doing, but I think many people were trying to be judicious about all of the additional resources that would be required should something be airborne. You know, for in more kind of developed economies, I think it's really, you know, quite challenging to be able to manage everyone getting their own room, negative pressure, N95, et cetera. I think for emerging economies, you know, it just sort of leaves this open question about what are they to do, you know, with those sorts of recommendations and without a clear plan in place. So I'm not necessarily saying that WHO or others made their decision based on that, but I think that was a consideration in sort of like what people are actually going to do with that information. My sense was that it was always safest to just bias towards, you know, a little bit more protection to mitigate and reduce risk. And I always sort of operated under the assumption that it was airborne.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Other than that, any major critiques of what they did or didn't do?
I think it's hard for me. I generally don't want to critique the WHO. That's my bias. Part of that is because there was sort of threats of funding kind of looming over everything that they were doing. They were sort of trying to do their best to kind of, you know, go to China and sort of learn and understand what happened and have a perspective coming out of that. And so I think in order to keep that invitation open, you know, I think they were trying to very much just be reasonable partners to them in the early part of COVID. So I think a lot of the criticism that ended up coming out, I don't know what they would have or should have done differently and why that would have benefited the WHO or why that would have benefited public health more broadly for the sort of like WHO is not there to represent the United Kingdom and the United States in interest, right? They're there to represent the sort of, you know, 3, 4, 5 billion people who basically don't have a voice in the world and sort of struggle with basic considerations around health. And I think with that perspective in mind, I think they were sort of going out and just trying to, you know, learn as much as they could.
I think it's interesting too. I mean, the criticisms I hear the most about like not declaring it airborne sooner seem to at this point be coming from the people who would not have done anything with that.
Exactly.
They would not have changed anything. They would not wear a mask. They would not wear a different mask.
Right.
Like it seems to be very disingenuous criticism. Absolutely. And one other thing, I mean, I liked that you said is that like you said you personally would err on the side of caution. And I agree. I would err on the side of caution. Like when I go out, I still wear a mask a lot of the time. And in terms of, I mean, erring on the side of caution, what do you think about the kind of where we are today, where there's the people who are like COVID zero extremists, there are the people who are kind of like in the middle, and then there are the people who want nothing at all? I feel like we're worse off than we ever were. We're worse than when we started. The like public health people seem to have a lot of them, not all of them, but a lot of them seem to be at this kind of like COVID zero impasse where obviously that's not going to work. It hasn't worked for years, and it is objectively too extreme in a lot of regards. I don't know how you feel about how things have gone today.
Yeah, I think with where we are today, I think I agree with you that there's this sort of polarity. And like, you know, people have sort of gone to like where they were, you know, if they wanted to sort of be extreme about not wearing masks and sort of, you know, not sort of being told or expected, you know, like with regard to how they act in a public health setting, I think that's sort of one group of people. I think there's a whole other group of people who are honestly like living in terror and extreme fear about COVID. And I think that, you know, as these things go, the truth is honestly somewhere in between, right? And that we don't know enough about like sort of transmission dynamics to feel comfortable about what we would say versus not say. But I do think like, for instance, we know some things to be pretty reasonable. Like it's probably okay to be outside, you know, like in a non-crowded place, especially if you're moving, you know, like you can go hiking without a mask. I think that's pretty safe to say, and not super controversial. I think people have, even in the setting, for instance, Ryan, of like getting vaccinated, having options on medications, et cetera, some people have not changed their posture. Like, you know, they may be sort of triple or quadruple vaxxed, you know, they may have access to medications, but they still somehow feel like it's not enough. And so in my mind, there's almost nothing you can do to sort of make that person feel sufficiently safe, right? And so I think the big thing that I just struggle with is where were all these people, you know, for flu, RSV, you know, everything that was happening before that we just accepted, even tacitly accepted as a society to be the normal ways in which we operated. Not to say that it was right. Like I've always thought it was ludicrous that you would take a bunch of sick people and you'd put them in emergency department waiting room sitting together, no masking or nothing. Like pre-COVID, it was just like ridiculous that we had all these people exposed to each other. But that aside, like we had some norms in society and these didn't seem to kind of bubble to the top. And so part of me is sort of worried that this is indicative of sort of broader challenges that people are having through this whole process: isolation, anxiety, depression, you know, fear, like these things, when taken together at the population level, don't usually end up leading to good outcomes.
When you bring up, though, flu and RSV, I mean, your point isn't necessarily to compare and say that COVID was equivalent to them, but it's to say we should have also been taking those things seriously, too, and we still should. And right now with the triple-demic, right, we're talking about RSV, flu, and COVID. Is it going, how, I mean, where are we at in this triple-demic? I don't know if people are actually using that term or if that's already phased out, but where are we? Are we in the middle of it? Have we peaked? You think that it's going as well as it could be? Or are you afraid for the next coming months of what will happen?
Well, I'm afraid, like, very much here in the near term, just with all of the holiday exposure and travel and all of that, sort of what the implications are. I think RSV had sort of more or less peaked and was coming down a little bit. It's still quite high. I think flu was on the rise, but it had sort of been on track with other years, except shifted earlier, like 4 months or something like that. You know, it's just like quite dramatic, the amount of flu we were having as early as we were having it. And so the question that I always have with flu, when it looks a little bit early, is like, are we going to level out and then have another peak, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like having an April peak is not mm-hmm. out of the question for flu, right? Like, so flu, you're never really comfortable, right? Until you hit the summer and it's decided it's moved on. And even then sometimes we get some residual. So, and then COVID is just changing dramatically. And I think if there's anything that we've learned is that like stop thinking that it's over and just start accepting that it's part of the way that we're going to have to live and operate. And we're all going to have to sift through, again, here's the information problem, sift through endless amounts of information to be able to mitigate and manage risk on our own. And again, if you don't have reliable people and sources of information or an ability to sort of discern amongst information on your own, it just creates chaos.
You know what? This shouldn't have surprised me, but I'm a dummy, so it did. But it the way things have fallen on political lines have surprised me here. And I'll give a weird example. I don't know if this is exactly related, but this is what it reminds me of. Here in San Francisco, when COVID started, they shut down some streets to traffic so that people could have space to walk around in. Because I think, you know, generally it was assumed fairly quickly that, you know, we could be outside relatively safely and people wanted to have places to walk around. And so they closed down these streets and they're called slow streets. You can drive through them if you are, like, if you live there, it's for, you know, local traffic only. But generally they're very, like, well received. People in the neighborhoods love them. There's one in my neighborhood. It's amazing. It's great. The kids get to ride their bikes on it. And there's cars still and Amazon trucks and still. But generally, it's more for, like, people walking and kids playing and people walking down the street. But not everybody likes it. For some reason, there are people who fucking hate it. And the reasons aren't entirely clear, but it really falls and breaks down on party lines. I was walking down the street the other day, and this dude was so mad that there was people walking in front of him. He started yelling and screaming, and he was like a guy who lives on the street. And I looked back and I'm like, what is the story with this guy? And not surprisingly, it was like a dude with, like, you know, Blue Lives stickers on his car. Don't blame me. I voted for Trump 2024 sort of stuff. And I got involved, and I shouldn't have because I'm dumb. And the guy starts yelling at me, and he's like, I don't want to use the word, but the derogatory word for homosexuals. And I steal a lot of gay valor, by the way. So I think he assumed that I was. I don't mind. I'll let him do that. And we got into this shouting match, and it was the most bizarre thing. And he was just like mad at me for being liberal. And I'm like, how do you even know that I am? And what does that have to do with anything that we're talking about here? It's like, I was so shocked that this dumb thing somehow became somehow political, when it's just about people walking down the street. And now this has happened here in medicine, and it still blows my mind. I don't get it. Let me ask you this. What do you think it's always going to be like this in medicine now? Is medicine going to be political? What's the next thing to be politicized? Is it the new vaccine? What's the next thing that's going to be politicized in a weird way that will shock me and that I don't see coming?
Drugs.
Oh, fentanyl? You think that might be it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's happening for sure already, right? That's the thing that's absolutely happened. What else is there? What's the next frontier of politicization of medicine? Is it colonoscopies? What is it going to be?
I think immunizations are always and have been really challenging, you know, starting with the sort of subgroup analysis in the Lancet paper on autism, right? Mm-hmm. Found to be sort of fabricated data, but sort of ticked off a huge sort of groundswell, I think, of people who felt emboldened. And ever since then, I think it's on the immunization side, at least, it's been quite challenging. If you go back, for instance, to polio vaccines, I was talking to some folks who were around here in Northern California when polio vaccines came out, and they were like, oh yeah, you know, like I remember going out to the Concord Navy Yard and we all lined up, right? And like we would wait in line for hours to get our polio vaccine, right? Like there was almost like a national duty, right, to do that. And then you fast forward sort of 50 years, whether it be kind of the MMR vaccines and then all the way through to COVID, anything where, you know, someone is recommending that you do something for someone else's benefit, I think is potentially challenging. I do think, though, I will just step back and say, I think medicine has largely just been polarized. I think this sort of opiates conversation, Ryan, extremely polarized, polarizing. The more recent stuff with Roe v. Wade, you know, these are all decisions that are made. Again, no matter where you fall on the spectrum here, these are decisions that are made that largely sort of undervalue expertise, mm-hmm. Because we've sort of allowed it to be that way. Like these are all decisions that are largely made without, practical or reasonable voices. And that's just not medical people letting that happen, right? That's yeah. People electing people to bypass medical decision making because they don't agree with it, right? So you can't always solve that problem. But again, if we're not leaning on expertise and you know what the best and right answers are, then we're sort of putting the whole thing at risk.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think it's all of public health at this point. Like, vaccines are a great starting area. I mean, COVID, any sort of like non-medical intervention that we have recommended for COVID has become very politicized and dramatized, I would say. I mean, drugs are a great topic, but it's really any sort of public health. And again, we're seeing it right now with like air quality and, I mean, gas stoves, as if that's like a political issue. We have consumer safety groups who do research and make recommendations. And so that again, I mean, I think just the entirety of public health has been so undermined. Maybe it didn't really have the footing we thought it had to stand on to begin with. But yeah, I mean, in terms of doing kind of like overdose prevention, air quality, vaccination, public health, infectious disease, all of this stuff, I mean, seems to have suffered detrimentally over the past several years.
Global health also, right? Like the sort of support of sort of countries where they have limited access to medical interventions, whether that be, you know, vaccines or medications or whatever happens. I mean, that has always come under fire. We do spend a large amount of money there, but I think we also do a huge amount of good, frankly. So
you're a real positive guy, Sanjeev. I love it. Give me, before we close up, two things. Let's give one more plug for because we have a lot of medical students and listening to this in pre-meds. Let's give one more plug for ID epidemiology. Let's I'm gonna give you a moment here to tell them why they should at least consider it.
Yeah, I think there are just a few simple reasons. It's one of the few things that you do where you treat to cure. Almost every single person that you're going to see, you're going to treat to cure. And those that you can't cure, we have pretty darn good medications for a lot of it to sort of help you treat patients and kind of live a long and relatively full life. So I think that's kind of one thing. Two, it's one of the few things where you sort of specialize in something without necessarily compromising everything. So if you're like me and you sort of love it all, ID was great because you still had to have a lot of core basic knowledge in order to sort of do it effectively and actually do it really well. And then the last thing is, you know, if you were to take off your kind of, US hat and put on a global hat, infectious diseases are still the most fundamental and maybe important thing happening, whether it be children under five, whether it be sort of, emerging economies, wherever you go, it's still sort of the kind of biggest threat. And I think as we look ahead to the next like 30, 40, 50 years, just with sort of climate transition happening, the amount of pandemics fundamentally shifting, the amount of multi-drug resistant organisms just expanding on a daily basis, whether that's TB or, CRE or whatever it happens to be. So Canada, for instance, not super excited about that spreading globally. So, the need is tremendous. The relevance globally is higher than it's ever been before. You get to sort of learn about everything. And you get to treat people to cure most of the time. So I think that's pretty compelling to me.
Yeah. Well done. All right. I'm going to do it. Fuck it. I don't have to go in at night, right? When they call me.
Rare circumstances. I'd say the couple times are one, malaria. If somebody has malaria, I've gone in for malaria two or three times. Mm-hmm. And then, if somebody has, bacterial meningitis, they could die. So, so I've gone in for bacterial meningitis once or twice, but that's it.
It's pretty exciting stuff. All right. Okay. Yeah. I'm sold. And where can people follow you, learn more about you, read about you, whatever, what else do you have to plug about yourself?
Oh God, I'm terrible at that. So I don't really have anything to follow or anything where I could, benefit from people paying attention. But I think I'm not terribly difficult to find. I think all my information is online. So especially if you have positive things to say, please reach out and happy to sort of pick up a conversation with anyone.
All right. That's Sanjeev Baxi, spelled Baxi, correct?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Very good. All right, Ryan. Where can people? Where people want to know? How do they find? Where's the Ryan? Where is the stuff that the Ryan has? What? Where can they find you?
I guess I'm still on Twitter at Ryan Marino and on Instagram at Dr. Ryan Marino.
And you're following him already, so I don't need to tell you to do that. But if for some reason you just learn how to operate a phone or a computer, make sure you're following him. All right. Thank you to Nadim. I'll plug. I'm going to be at Sketchfest next weekend on the 21st. I'll be doing an episode of Behind the Bastards live. That should be a ton of fun. I think it's sold out, but I was told that there might be tickets at the door. I don't know. But you should do Sketchfest. If you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, you should definitely check out Sketchfest. It's a couple of weeks where we have all these great comedic acts coming to town. The Kids in the Hall are going to be here. There's going to be a Perfect Strangers reunion. Come on. How rad is that? A roast of Bruce Campbell. It's going to be a blast. So it's like one of my favorite times of the year here in San Francisco. So I recommend checking it out if you're in the area. And if you want to follow me at Twitter, it's at the House of Pod, or just listen to the show. Thank you guys so much for coming on. It was really a pleasure. You guys are awesome.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Yeah, you're awesome.
I am.
This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a physician or other qualified healthcare provider for your specific healthcare needs or concerns. The opinions expressed on this podcast do not represent the opinions of our employees. Details in the podcast have been changed so that patient identification is not possible. And I'm alive and I want to stay. For the first time I'm on my way. And I'm ready for the world. I'm ready for the girl.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.